Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into a really interesting compound. It's called 5-amino-1-methylquinolinium.
Or 5A1MQ for short, thankfully.
Right. Much easier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been getting a lot of buzz, a lot of persistent interest, really, in metabolic research circles. Our mission today is to get you, the listener, up to speed, really well informed, quickly.
Yeah, this molecule gets described as a potential metabolic game changer. And, you know, there's a reason for that. It targets this core enzyme, a real bottleneck in our metabolism.
Okay.
So we're going to plunge into how it works, its mechanism. We'll look at the data. We have mostly animal studies, we should say up front, but still promising.
And anecdotal reports too, right?
Yeah.
People are actually using this for research.
Exactly. And we need to evaluate those, see if the results people are reporting anecdotally can justify what is, let's be honest, pretty significant cost.
A very steep cost from what I've seen. We'll definitely get into that. But first, a really important point for anyone trying to follow along or do their own digging.
Oh, absolutely crucial.
If you're researching this, you have to be flexible with the search terms. It's the names get swapped around a lot in the papers.
That's right. You need to search for the full name, 5-amino-1-methylquinolinium, but also watch out for a slightly different spelling, 5-amino-1-methylquinolin, just quinolin at the end.
Okay, quinolinium and quinoline. Got it.
And maybe even more critical, especially for finding the core mechanism papers, is using the acronym NNMTI.
NNMTI. What does that stand for again?
Nicotinamide N-methyltransferase inhibitor. It's listed right on PubChem as a synonym. And understanding that target enzyme, NNMT, well, that's not just a detail. It's everything. It's the key to how this compound works.
All right. So we're diving deep today. We've got animal studies, molecular research, some detailed real-world user reports. We're going to unpack it all for you. Let's start with that enzyme you mentioned, NNMT.
Okay. NNMT, nicotinamide N-methyltransferase. It's, think of it as a critical governor for your metabolism. People use analogies like a toll booth sometimes.
Toll booth, I like that. So it slows things down, creates a bottleneck.
It does, but it's a bit more active than just slowing traffic. Let's get into the biochemistry. NNMT's job is to take nicotinamide, which is, you know, a vital precursor for NAD+.
NAD+, super important for energy, right?
Absolutely fundamental. NNMT grabs that nicotinamide and essentially shunts it out of the useful NAD plus salvage pathway. It performs a methylation reaction using SAMe, S-adenosylmethionine.
Okay, so it's modifying the nicotinamide.
Exactly. It adds a methyl group, turning it into 1-methylnicotinamide or 1-MNA. And this 1-MNA, the body just gets rid of it, excretes it.
So the enzyme isn't just creating a traffic jam like the toll booth analogy might suggest.
Mm-hmm.
It's actively stealing the construction materials, the nicotinamide that the body needs to make NAD plus energy.
Precisely. By forcing this reaction, NNMT effectively lowers the available pool of nicotinamide. And the direct consequence of that is it actively lowers the crucial NAD plus levels inside your cells.
Wow. Okay, that makes sense. And here's the really crucial part, I think. Why is this NNMT enzyme often overexpressed? What does that link up with?
That's where it gets really relevant to metabolic health. NNMT is very often found to be overexpressed, meaning it's hyperactive, in people who are overweight, dealing with insulin resistance, or generally metabolically unhealthy.
So it's almost like a marker for metabolic dysfunction.
You could see it that way. Think of it as the cell sort of hunkering down, shifting into this very conservative survival mode. When NNMT is running high, it's basically sending these quiet signals to the cell. Reduce energy spending, slow down turnover, and definitely store any incoming calories as fat.
Because it's lowering NAD plus cell.
Exactly. By lowering NAD plus cell, the cell loses its capacity to repair itself, to run efficiently, to operate at peak. You basically shift from state of thriving metabolically to just surviving. And that promotes fat accumulation and just generally slows down your whole metabolism.
Okay, so the goal then with 5A1MQ is to specifically counteract that, to inhibit NNMT. But you mentioned there are other NNMT inhibitors out there. What makes 5A1MQ stand out? Why the buzz around this specific one?
Right. Good question. Its value really comes down to two key things, selectivity and bioavailability. Let's talk selectivity first.
Okay.
The research we have clearly documents 5A1MQ as being highly selective for the NNMT enzyme. It specifically targets that methylation reaction, the conversion of nicotinamide to 1-MNA, primarily in two key tissues.
Which are?
Adipose tissue, so your fat cells, and the liver.
And why is that tissue selectivity so important? Mm-hmm. Doesn't methylation happen everywhere?
It does, and that's exactly the point. Methylation is fundamental for countless processes. If you just carpet bomb the system with a non-selective methylation inhibitor, you risk messing up all sorts of vital things, especially in the liver, where methylation is critical for, drug metabolism, detoxification pathways, keeping homocysteine in check.
So a non-selective inhibitor could cause collateral damage.
Big time. 5A1MQ seems to be much more surgical. It doesn't appear to significantly interfere with those other beneficial methylation enzymes that are doing important jobs in the fat or liver tissue. So you're clearing that specific metabolic bottleneck, the NNMT1, without, gumming up the rest of the essential machinery.
This sounds like a huge advantage. Okay, what about the second point? Bioavailability.
This is about how well the compound actually gets to where it needs to go. Among the various NNMT inhibitors being looked at in research, 5A1MQ consistently shows the highest cell membrane permeability.
Meaning it gets into the cells easily.
Much more effectively, yes. It can cross those cell walls and reach the NNMT enzyme inside the cell better than many of its counterparts. And obviously, higher permeability generally translates to higher bioavailability, more of the compound reaching the target, and therefore potentially higher efficacy. It gets in and does its job better.
Okay, makes sense. So let's tie it together. We use 5A1MQ. It selectively gets into fat and liver cells. It blocks that NNMT toll booth, stops it from stealing nicotinamide. What's the immediate payoff inside the cell? What happens next?
The effect is pretty immediate and quite dramatic biochemically. When NNMT is blocked, that nicotinamide isn't turned into the waste product 1-MNA. Instead, it's preserved, it stays available, and it gets funneled right back into that NAD plus salvage pathway.
So you're recycling it properly now.
Exactly. And the result is that NAD plus levels inside the cell can, well, they absolutely skyrocket. We're talking about fundamentally shifting the cell's energy profile almost instantly.
From surviving back to thriving.
That's the idea. The cells move away from that low power, often inflammatory survival state back towards a mode focused on growth, repair, and optimal function. Thrival is a good word for it. Inflammation tends to decrease. Mitochondrial function gets a major boost because NAD plus is abundant again.
It's like the key cofactor they were missing.
Precisely. And you start to repair that underlying infrastructure decay that always accompanies chronically low NAD plus levels. You've essentially taken the foot off the biggest metabolic handbrake in the system.
Okay, so this foundational shift inside the cell, cranking up in NAD plus levels, that doesn't just stay local, right? It starts showing up in bigger systemic ways. Let's talk about the effects on metabolism and body composition, starting with the animal data. What does it show for fat loss?
Yeah, the animal studies are pretty consistent and frankly compelling. They show that 5A1MQ holds promise for actually reversing obesity that's been induced by diet.
Reversing it, not just slowing it down.
That's what the data suggests in these models. And it seems to tackle the excess fat problem in a couple of ways. It's not just about encouraging fat breakdown, but also about changing the fat cell itself.
How so? I remember reading something about the size of the fat cell.
Exactly. The sources detail that 5A1MQ appears to reduce the physical size of the adipocyte, the fat cell. It addresses that hypertrophy, the swelling of fat cells, and by doing that, it shrinks the overall fat mass.
So the cell becomes less of just a storage depot.
Right. When NAD plus is high, the signals inside the cell shift towards being metabolically active, not just passively storing energy. And beyond shrinking existing cells, the molecule also seems to take aim at the creation of new fat.
Ah, lipogenesis.
Correct. The data suggests it reduces or inhibits lipogenesis. The thinking is, if the body is running so efficiently, burning energy well, it stops getting the signal to prepare for an energy famine by building more fat storage.
Now, there was one point in the sources, something about preventing fat accumulation even in a caloric surplus. That sounds, well, almost too good to be true, given basic thermodynamics. How seriously should we take that claim?
Yeah, that specific claim needs to be approached with, let's say, a healthy dose of skepticism, especially when you're thinking about translating animal results, often under controlled feeding, to humans who might be eating freely.
Right. Calories in, calories out still matters.
Fundamentally, yes. While 5A1MQ might dramatically ramp up the efficiency of how your body handles energy, making it better at burning fat, it's highly unlikely to completely defy physics. If you're consistently taking in thousands of extra calories, that energy has to go somewhere.
But maybe it changes where it goes.
That's the more plausible angle. The compound does seem to increase fat metabolism within the fat cell itself. It boosts lipolysis fat breakdown because those mitochondria are now flooded with the NAD plus they need to work properly. So maybe if you're in a slight surplus, your body might be better at dissipating some of that extra energy as heat or using it for other processes rather than storing it all as fat. But it's not a magic bullet against overeating. Energy balance is still king.
Understood. Okay, beyond just fat loss, what about broader metabolic health? things like insulin sensitivity.
That's where the systemic benefits really start to shine. When you inhibit NNMT, you don't just boost NAD plus dealer. Remember that methylation reaction uses samine?
Yeah, as adenosylmethionine.
Well, when you block NNMT, you also tend to increase the levels of SAM within the fat cell alongside the NAD plus dyne. Both of these are crucial for cellular energy metabolism, electron exchange, all that good stuff. But specifically regarding glucose and insulin.
Yes.
NNMT inhibition has been shown to increase the expression of something called GLUT4.
GLUT4, that's the glucose transporter, right? The one that lets sugar into muscle and fat cells.
Exactly. It's the main doorway for glucose. So by increasing GLUT4 expression, 5A1MQ essentially makes it easier for your cells, especially your skeletal muscle cells, to pull glucose out of the bloodstream.
Ah, so the muscles get better at soaking up sugar after a meal, which would improve insulin sensitivity.
Precisely. Your muscles become more efficient at glucose disposal. This means your pancreas doesn't have to work as hard, doesn't have to pump out as much insulin to get the same amount of glucose cleared from your blood. That's a huge win for preventing or improving insulin resistance, and it has massive implications for long-term metabolic health, even anti-aging.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, this brings us nicely to the real-world stuff, the anecdotal reports. These often highlight nuances the lab studies miss. We have details from one user running 150 milligrams a day. What did they observe?
Well, they definitely saw signs of that improved glucose metabolism we just talked about. They noted their blood glucose readings, on average, dropped by about 5 to 7 points.
That's noticeable.
Yeah. And interestingly, because they were already on a very low-carb ketogenic diet, this sometimes pushed them into brief bouts of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, which really confirms that GLUT4 mechanism is likely doing its job, pulling glucose into the cells more effectively.
Okay, so the internal metabolic markers lined up. What about visually? Body composition changes.
This is where the anecdotal report adds a really interesting layer. The user reported looking visually fuller and harder. They saw quite quickly, actually, noticeably leaner conditioning in their upper body, abs, chest, arms, back. And they mentioned visible vascularity, saying they saw veins under my skin everywhere after only about a week at that 150 milligram dose.
A week? That seems fast for significant fat loss. What's going on there?
I agree. It's likely not just pure fat loss in that short time frame. That rapid change in vascularity and the harder look probably speaks more to the immediate shift in cellular energy status and maybe cellular hydration. When NAD plus levels jump up so dramatically, cells manage glycogen and water differently. Things can tighten up. You look more refined, almost shrink-wrapped.
Interesting. But here's the crucial contrast, the aha moment from that report. While they saw great results generally, and especially on the upper body mentioning lower back fat melting off, they specifically noted disappointing results on stubborn lower body fat, especially compared to other compounds they'd researched, like tamoxifen.
Yes, and this is a critical point for anyone listening to understand. 5A1MQ seems to be a fantastic general metabolic optimizer. It revs up the whole engine. But stubborn fat areas, particularly lower body fat in men or hips and thighs in women, often have a strong hormonal component driving them.
Like localized estrogen sensitivity or maybe alpha-2 receptor activity.
Exactly those kinds of factors. If the primary reason fat is clinging to a specific area is hormonal signaling, just fixing the main metabolic engine with NNMT inhibition isn't necessarily going to override that specific hormonal signal.
So 5A1MQ fixes the engine, but it doesn't necessarily fix the specific localized steering issues caused by hormones in those stubborn spots.
That's a great way to put it. It strongly suggests that for those really stubborn, often hormonally driven fat deposits, you might need a more targeted intervention in addition to the general metabolic boost from 5A1MQ. You need to address the specific mechanism holding that fat there, which might not be NNMT related at all.
Okay, let's broaden the scope now. Beyond fat loss and general metabolism, there's research looking at skeletal muscle longevity, organ health. What are we seeing regarding muscle specifically?
There's some intriguing stuff here, particularly around muscle stem cells. Studies indicate that inhibiting NNMT can actually activate quiescent stem cells within skeletal muscle.
Quiescent, meaning dormant or sleeping stem cells.
Exactly. So the idea is you're essentially waking up the muscle's own internal repair and regeneration crew. This holds potential, theoretically, for improving recovery from exercise or injury, maybe enhancing hypertrophy, or even combating age-related muscle loss, sarcopenia.
Waking up the repair crew. That sounds incredibly promising, especially for aging or recovery.
It does. You're potentially improving the fundamental capacity for muscle tissue maintenance and repair by boosting NAD plus and activating these cells.
There's
However,
always a however, isn't there?
there often is. We have to immediately bring in that counterpoint from the anecdotal report we discussed. Remember, this user was pushing performance hard using an anabolic stack, yet was in a caloric deficit. And they explicitly reported no noticeable increase in actual strength, raw contractile force, over several weeks of using 150 milligrams of 5-HT1-MQ.
That seems contradictory. If you have more cellular energy, ATP, better infrastructure, why no strength increase? What does that tell us?
It suggests a really important distinction. 5-HT1-MQ appears to provide the fuel via NAD plus enabling more ATP and maybe improve the efficiency of the repair processes, the construction crew, if you will. But contractile strength itself depends on more than just fuel. It needs neural drive, efficient muscle fiber recruitment, and crucially, the actual synthesis of new contractile proteins, new myofibrils.
And that synthesis requires building blocks and an anabolic signal, which might be limited in a deficit, even with high NAD plus NAME.
Precisely. 5-HT1-MQ doesn't seem to act as a direct muscle-building agent itself, nor does it appear to significantly boost central nervous system output for force production. If you're in a calorie deficit, your body's ability to build new muscle protein is likely capped, regardless of how much energy currency you have floating around.
So it might improve the quality of recovery, help repair damage more efficiently, but it's not a strength or a muscle mass builder on its own. It facilitates, rather than drives, hypertrophy.
That seems to be the most accurate interpretation based on the combined data and anecdote. It helps the recovery potential, but you still need the stimulus and the resources. A key takeaway for anyone using it purely for performance gains.
Definitely. Okay, let's pivot to internal organ health. The liver came up earlier as a key tissue where NNMT acts. What's the connection to liver disease?
This is a really significant area. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD, is exploding globally. It's a huge health crisis, and the research strongly links the overexpression of NNMT in the liver to the development and progression of NAFLD.
So high NNMT activity in the liver promotes fatty liver.
It seems to play a key role. It contributes to steatosis, which is that fatty degeneration, and potentially even fibrosis, the scarring. The mechanism ties back to NAD++. By inhibiting NNMT in the liver, you boost NAD plus levels there, which helps shift the liver's metabolic signaling away from fat storage and inflammation and back towards healthier function.
So inhibiting NNMT could potentially prevent or even help reverse fatty liver disease progression.
That's the therapeutic hope, and the research is heading in that direction. It's about restoring healthy metabolic function within the liver cells themselves.
And linking this back to broader cellular health, there was also mention of anti-cancer potential. How does that fit in?
It makes logical sense, actually. We talked about how high NNMT activity is part of this survival mode metabolism. Well, that kind of metabolic environment, characterized by altered NAD plus dynamics, is often exactly what helps fuel unhealthy cells, like senescent cells or cancer cells. They thrive in that dysregulated state.
So NNMT kind of helps create the soil for these bad cells.
In a way, yes. And specifically with 5-HT1-MQ, there was research showing it could inhibit the growth and activity of HeLa cells.
Those are a well-known line of cervical cancer cells used in research, right?
Correct. 5-HT1-MQ showed dose-dependent inhibition of their proliferation. The idea is by cutting off that NNMT pathway, you might be limiting a crucial metabolic adaptation that these rapidly dividing unhealthy cells rely on. You're essentially disrupting their preferred fuel supply or metabolic environment.
Fascinating. Okay, finally in this section, let's talk about energy. This is often the first thing people feel when researching compounds like this, but it's described differently than, say, caffeine.
Yes, and that distinction is critical. The energy boost from 5-HT1-MQ is reported as being fundamentally cellular. It's not a jittery, stimulant-like feeling.
Why not? What's the source of the energy?
It comes directly from fixing the machinery. Your mitochondria, the power plants in your cells, are simply making ATP, the energy currency, more effectively because they're no longer starved for NAD plus faster. You're repairing the underlying infrastructure decay.
So it's not artificially whipping the system, it's making the system run better on its own.
Exactly. And this translates typically into increased endurance, less fatigue setting in during workouts or just during the day. People often report a significant reduction in that post-workout crash or mid-afternoon slump.
It's like going from a car engine full of sludge to a clean, tuned engine. It just runs smoother and longer.
That's a perfect analogy. Some users also report improved mental clarity or focus, maybe improved neural drive, likely because the brain is incredibly energy hungry and its power systems are running cleaner too.
But it's not a guaranteed fix for all fatigue, right?
No, definitely not. We need to be careful there. If someone's fatigue stems from a different bottleneck, maybe an issue further down the line in the electron transport chain, for example, they might actually respond better, at least initially, to other mitochondrial support compounds. Things like ubiquinol, the active form of CoQ10, might be more relevant for them.
So you need to figure out where your specific energy bottleneck is. 5A1MQ targets the NAD plus availability issue via NNMT.
Precisely. It's a powerful tool for that specific mechanism, but it's not a universal fatigue cure-all.
All right, let's get practical. We've talked about the mechanisms, the potential benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Now for the realities of actually researching this compound. And the first hurdle for many is likely the cost. It's not cheap.
No, it's definitely not. This is what we call the sticker shock factor, and it's crucial for anyone considering this to understand why. A big part of it is the formulation. Typically, 5A1MQ is sold as an iodide salt.
Okay, an iodide salt, what does that mean in practical terms?
It means the powder or capsule you buy isn't 100% pure 5A1MQ. The math works out so that roughly 1.89 milligrams of this iodide salt contains only 1 milligram of the actual active 5A1MQ molecule.
Wow, so the active ingredient is only about 53% of the total weight.
Exactly. You're paying for almost double the material by weight than the active compound you're getting.
That definitely impacts the cost per effective dose.
Massively. If you look at raw base supplier costs for the iodide salt, it might be somewhere around, say, 21 USD per gram. But let's translate that to a daily dose. If someone is researching the commonly cited performance dose, 150 milligrams of active 5A1MQ per day.
They need more than 150 milligrams of the salt, right? Because it's only 53% active.
Right. They'd need about 283 milligrams of the iodide salt formulation each day. And just doing the math, at that 21-gram base price, that single day's supply costs roughly $6.
$6 a day at base cost. And that's before any markup from vendors.
Correct. That's before accounting for testing, encapsulation, bottling, distribution, profit margins. So the price the end user pays online is often significantly higher, easily double or triple that base cost.
So running 150 milligrams a day for, say, a typical 60-day research cycle.
Yeah.
You're looking at a pretty substantial investment, hundreds of dollars potentially.
Easily. It puts it in a cost category comparable to running a pretty extensive stack of other well-known, often pricey research compounds or peptides used for fat burning, like maybe HGH fragment plus cartarine, GW1616, or similar combinations.
So this isn't like picking up a bottle of vitamin C. It's a serious budget consideration.
Mm. Absolutely. It requires planning and budgeting. Compared to maybe some other longevity molecules people research, like nicotinamide riboside, NR or NMN, 5A1MQ usually comes in at a notably higher daily cost. It really positions itself as a more intensive, targeted research intervention rather than just a casual daily supplement.
Okay, point taken on the cost. Assuming someone decides the potential benefits warrant the investment, what are the dosing protocols people are using? Based on the research and those anecdotal reports, let's start with oral dosing.
For oral use, the research suggests an effective range starts relatively low, maybe around 50 milligrams per day of the active compound.
And what would that 50 milligram dose be aimed at?
That might be considered a minimum effective dose, perhaps suitable for more general longevity support, or maybe addressing only mild metabolic sluggishness, sort of a maintenance dose.
But for more significant effects, like noticeable fat loss or performance enhancement?
Then the dose typically needs to go higher. The range usually discussed is somewhere between that 50 milligram floor up to maybe 200 milligrams per day.
And within that range, is there a consensus on an optimal spot, anecdotally?
The 150 milligrams per day mark comes up very frequently in user reports as being a kind of sweet spot. It seems to offer a good balance between noticeable effects on body composition and energy without necessarily pushing into significant side effects for most.
And how should that 150 milligrams be taken? All at once?
No, definitely not recommended. The key is splitting the dose. Ideally, that 150 milligrams would be divided into three separate servings throughout the day.
Like morning, midday, or pre-workout, and evening.
Exactly. Maybe 50 milligrams at breakfast, 50 milligrams before training or mid-afternoon, and the final 50 milligrams before bed.
Why the split dosing?
It's about maintaining relatively stable inhibition of the NNMT enzyme over the full 24-hour cycle. If you take it all at once, you get a big spike, but then levels might drop off. Split dosing aims to keep NAD plus levels consistently elevated for longer, maximizing the potential benefits.
Makes sense. Now, you mentioned side effects. Is there a specific issue with higher doses, especially related to timing?
Yes, there's a common report, particularly if people push the dose above 150 milligrams, or if they take a large portion, like maybe 100 milligram or two capsules, right before trying to sleep.
What happens?
Increased thermogenesis. Basically, your body temperature goes up, and you might find yourself sweating more, feeling uncomfortably warm. This can definitely interfere with sleep quality.
Which kind of defeats the purpose if you're aiming for better recovery.
Absolutely. So careful dose titration and avoiding large doses close to bedtime seems key to managing that potential acute side effect. Pacing is important.
Okay, what about injectable forms? We mentioned it's available. Is the dosing different?
Yes, significantly different and generally much lower. Injectable administration, usually subcutaneous, just under the skin, bypasses the first pass metabolism in the liver that oral compounds go through.
So more gets into circulation directly.
Correct, leading to higher bioavailability. Because of this, injectable doses are measured in micrograms, MCG, not milligrams. The typical range seems to be somewhere between 250 milligrams up to maybe 1,000 milligrams per day.
And is there an average or common dose for injectable?
500 milligrams per day is a figure that pops up quite often anecdotally as providing a powerful effect. Injectable is generally considered more potent, and users sometimes report feeling the effects more rapidly compared to oral.
Got it. Finally, for practical application, cycling. Does this need to be cycled? Given how effectively it targets NNMT, does the body adapt?
Yes, cycling appears to be necessary for maintaining peak effectiveness, especially at those higher performance-oriented doses.
Why? What happens with continuous use?
The sources and user reports indicate that the perceived benefits, the efficacy, tends to sort of slow down or plateau after a period of continuous use. This typically happens around the 60-day mark, maybe somewhere between 4 to 8 weeks.
Is that tolerance, like receptor downregulation?
It doesn't seem to be a receptor issue in the typical sense. It's more likely the body's complex enzymatic system starting to compensate. The body might upregulate other pathways to deal with the metabolic shift or adapt to the sustained NNMT inhibition in other ways, which eventually lessens that initial dramatic NAD plus spike.
So the initial wow factor fades a bit.
Right. The body finds a new equilibrium. To recapture that strong initial effect, cycling off seems necessary.
Okay, so what are the suggested cycle lengths or rotation strategies?
For performance or aggressive fat loss goals, people often structure cycles based on their training phases, or mesocycles. Typical suggestions might be running it for, say, 8 to 12 weeks, maybe up to 20 weeks in some protocols, but always followed by a planned off period of several weeks.
To lull the body to reset.
Exactly, to let those compensatory mechanisms dial back down so that when you reintroduce the compound, you get that potent NAD plus boost again.
What about for longevity purposes if someone's using that lower 50 milligram dose?
For pure longevity or maintenance, a cycling strategy might be different. Some suggest that a low dose, maybe 50 milligrams once a day, could potentially be used for longer periods. Or another approach mentioned is using it only intermittently, like just on weekends, or even just once a week, perhaps indefinitely. The idea there is to get periodic boosts in NAD+ without pushing the system into constant adaptation.
Okay, we've covered the compound itself, the dosing, the cost, the cycling. Now let's talk about unleashing its full potential. Like many research compounds, 5A1MQ really seems to shine when it's stacked synergistically with other things.
Absolutely. If you think of 5A1MQ as successfully clearing a major traffic jam on the metabolic highway by removing that NNMT bottleneck,
then the next logical step is to make sure the highway is optimally used.
Right.
Maybe add more fuel-efficient cars or make sure the fuel delivery is top-notch.
Exactly. You want to ensure that the now clear pathway is fully fueled and utilized. This leads us to the foundational stack elements. What do you need to make sure is abundant once NNMT is out of the way?
Well, NAD plus itself, presumably, since that's what NNMT was lowering.
Precisely. Some of the most compelling anecdotal reports showing the best body composition changes come from protocols that combine 5A1MQ with additional NAD plus support, often injectable NAD plus dang.
So you unlock the drain, NNMT inhibition, and simultaneously pour more water, NAD plus, down it.
That's the concept. You're ensuring the system is absolutely saturated with the key molecule whose availability you just increased. You're maximizing the potential of that unblocked pathway.
Okay, so NAD plus support is foundational. What's the other key piece mentioned for synergy, especially regarding fat burning?
L-carnitine.
Ah, carnitine. How does that synergize? Its main role is fat transport, isn't it?
Yes, L-carnitine is like the essential delivery truck for fat metabolism. Its primary job is to shuttle fatty acids across the mitochondrial membrane, getting them inside the power plant where they can actually be burned for energy. It helps prioritize fat burning over using glucose or even muscle tissue.
Okay, so carnitine brings the logs to the furnace.
And 5A1MQ makes sure that furnace is burning incredibly hot and efficiently because it's got all the NAD plus it needs. The synergy is beautiful. Carnitine shoves the fatty acids into the mitochondria, and 5A1MQ, by boosting NAD plus NOMAC, ensures the mitochondria can metabolize those fatty acids much faster and more completely.
So, better delivery and better burning. Makes sense. This combination sounds powerful, but one source took it even further, describing a stack that creates a biological juggernaut. This involves adding another compound, MOTSC.
Ah, yes, MOTSC. This is where the analogy shifts from just optimizing the existing system to actually upgrading the hardware.
Hardware upgrade, how so?
Think of it like this. 5A1MQ is like a crucial software patch. It optimizes the operating system, removes the NNMT limiter, and fills your existing cellular batteries, mitochondria, with the necessary charge, NAD plus.
Okay, software patch. What's MOTSC then?
MOTSC, which stands for mitochondrial open reading frame of the 12S RNA type C, quite a mouthful, is more like the hardware upgrade. MOTSC is a peptide known to stimulate mitochondrial biogenesis.
Biogenesis, meaning creating new mitochondria.
Exactly. You're literally building new power plants, new cellular batteries. So while 5A1MQ makes your current batteries run at peak efficiency, MOTSC builds you more batteries, potentially higher capacity ones.
Wow. So you install a brand new, bigger engine with MOTSC and simultaneously tune the fuel lines and remove the factory speed limiter with 5A1MQ.
That's the idea. You combine the hardware upgrade with the software optimization. The reported result isn't just additive, it's synergistic. The source described it as 1 plus 1 equals 11, a massive leap in metabolic capacity, energy production, and potentially recovery.
A biological juggernaut indeed. Okay, powerful stuff. Now, for listeners maybe more focused on longevity than pure performance, there's another side to the NAD plus equation we need to consider, right? NNMT isn't the only thing that consumes NAD plus men.
That's a critical point for the anti-aging angle. NNMT is one major consumer, but another huge one is an enzyme called CD38.
CD38, what's its role?
CD38 activity often increases with age and inflammation, and it's a major drain on NAD plus levels. It basically chews through NAD plus as part of cellular signaling processes, often related to stress responses. High levels of both NNMT and CD38 are seen as metabolically unfavorable, potentially fueling things like cellular senescence, aging, and maybe even creating environments where cancer cells thrive.
So if you block NNMT with 5A1MQ, but CD38 is still running rampant and consuming NAD plus MAKE, you're not getting the maximum benefit.
Exactly. You've plugged one leak in the bucket, but there's still another big hole draining your precious NAD plus meat. To really maximize that NAD plus pool, especially for longevity and reducing age-related decline, addressing high CD38 activity is also important.
Okay, so how do you lower CD38? What are the options mentioned?
There are some well-researched natural compounds that show promise as CD38 inhibitors. Two popular ones that came up are apigenin, found in things like parsley and chamomile, and EGCG.
EGCG, that's the really beneficial compound in green tea, right?
Yeah, that's the one. EGCG acts as a known CD38 inhibitor, helping to preserve the NAD plus that 5A1MQ is already trying to conserve by blocking NNMT. So they work on two different drains, potentially leading to even higher sustained NAD plus levels.
But getting enough EGCG from just drinking green tea can be tough for a therapeutic effect, can't it?
Yes, that's a practical challenge. To reach the kind of dosages often used in studies showing significant CD38 inhibition, we're talking maybe around 500 milligrams of EGCG daily. You'd have to drink an almost impractical amount of regular green tea. So people researching this usually turn to concentrated green tea extract supplements to get that level of EGCG.
Got it. Now, a word of caution came up about stacking too many inhibitors. Is it possible to go overboard with blocking these pathways?
It seems so. There's a potential risk if you get too aggressive. For example, if you combine 5A1MQ and NNMT inhibitor with high-dose EGCG, a CD38 inhibitor, but it also has some NNMT inhibiting properties, and maybe add quercetin, another compound with some NNMT inhibitory effects, you might drive the overall inhibition too far.
What's the danger in over-inhibiting? Isn't less NNMT always better?
Not necessarily. While high NNMT is often problematic, the enzyme does serve physiological functions, particularly related to methylation balance. If you suppress these pathways too much, you could potentially run into issues like maybe disrupting homocysteine metabolism and causing levels to rise, or perhaps even experiencing symptoms related to excess nicotinamide that isn't being properly cleared. It's about finding the right balance, not complete obliteration.
Okay, so how can someone monitor this? How do they know if they're in the sweet spot of inhibition versus going too far?
Well, one sophisticated way to get a sense of your NNMT status is to actually measure that metabolite we talked about earlier, 1-MNA, 1-methylnicotinamide.
The direct output product of the NNMT enzyme.
Exactly. If someone gets tested and finds their 1-MNA levels are, say, way up in the 90th percentile, that's a strong indicator that their NNMT enzyme is highly active, and they might be a prime candidate to benefit from an inhibitor like 5A1MQ. Conversely, tracking 1-MNA while using an inhibitor could potentially give feedback on whether the inhibition is effective or perhaps too strong if levels drop extremely low. It offers a more direct biological marker to monitor the pathway you're targeting.
Okay, we've covered the potential upsides extensively. Now, it's absolutely essential we discuss the potential risks and how to mitigate them. 5A1MQ isn't risk-free, and inhibiting an enzyme like NNMT long-term requires careful consideration.
This is arguably the most critical part of the conversation for anyone considering researching this. NNMT, despite being a metabolic bottleneck we want to open, isn't purely a villain. It actually plays some beneficial roles, particularly protective ones, that we need to account for if we're going to suppress it.
A protective role.
Specifically in the endothelium. That's the delicate single-cell layer that lines all of your blood vessels and the inside of your heart. NNMT activity there seems to help manage oxidative stress.
How does it do that?
It's complex, but part of it relates to managing the flux of metabolites in the NAD plus pathways. When NAD plus levels surge dramatically, as they do with an NNMT inhibition, if the downstream recycling isn't perfect, sometimes certain intermediate metabolites can accumulate that might actually be pro-oxidant, potentially stressing that sensitive endothelial lining. NNMT normally provides a bit of a buffer against this by shunting some nicotinamide away.
So by inhibiting NNMT long-term, especially if the system is under high metabolic demand, we might inadvertently increase oxidative stress, specifically in our cardiovascular system lining.
That's the theoretical risk, yes. You're removing a natural protective mechanism. Therefore, if you're going to inhibit NNMT using 5A1MQ, implementing countermeasures to protect the endothelium from potential oxidative stress becomes non-negotiable. It's essential mitigation.
Okay, non-negotiable protection. What specifically is needed? What are the countermeasures?
The sources emphasize needing sufficient levels of three key protective compounds. First, antioxidants. High-dose vitamin C is recommended, with figures around 6 grams per day mentioned.
6 grams? That's quite high.
It is, reflecting the need for robust antioxidant defense. Second is vitamin E, another powerful antioxidant, typically suggested around 400 IU international units.
Okay, vitamin C and E, what's the third protective element? This one surprised me a bit.
Estradiol or E2?
Estradiol. Estrogen. Why is that critical for endothelial protection in this context?
Estradiol has well-known protective effects on the cardiovascular system, independent of its reproductive roles. It helps maintain the health and integrity of the endothelial lining, improves vasodilation, and enhances the body's own defenses against oxidative damage and inflammation within the blood vessels.
So having adequate E2 levels provides an additional layer of protection that becomes even more important when NNMT is inhibited.
Exactly. The research suggests maintaining healthy, sufficient physiological levels, not deficient levels. For men, the target often cited is around 30 picograms per milliliter, PGML, which is generally considered optimal for cardiovascular health anyway. If someone's E2 levels are suppressed or very low while they're running 5A1MQ, the risk of that endothelial oxidative stress could potentially increase significantly.
Wow. So this compound almost forces you to ensure your broader hormonal health, specifically E2, is also optimized for safety.
It highlights the interconnectedness of these systems. You can't just tweak one metabolic enzyme in isolation without considering the downstream effects and necessary support systems. Robust antioxidant support, CNE, plus healthy E2 levels seem crucial for mitigating this specific risk.
Okay, that's a very clear warning and mitigation strategy.
Right.
Let's shift from the molecular risk to a more physiological one that was mentioned, the risk of simply over-revving.
Yes, this is a practical issue. When you suddenly fix a major energy bottleneck and your ATP production ramps up, you often feel fantastic, like dramatically better, maybe like you felt 10 or 20 years ago.
That sounds like a good problem to have.
It feels great, but the risk lies in the enthusiasm. Users might feel so energized that they immediately want to go full throttle in their workouts or activities. They jump back into heavy lifting or intense cardio at a level their body isn't currently conditioned for.
Ah, so the central nervous system and the energy levels feel ready to go, but the physical structures haven't caught up.
Exactly. Your brain and muscles feel the energy boost almost instantly, but your tendons, ligaments, cartilage, your connective tissues, they adapt much more slowly. They need gradual increases in load to strengthen. If you suddenly feel like you can lift 20% more and you do it before your tendons are ready for that new peak force,
now you risk a non-contact injury like a tendon strain or tear.
Precisely. It's an avoidable injury caused by enthusiasm outpacing structural adaptation. The key is gradual progression. You have to consciously ramp up the intensity and load over weeks, respecting the timeline of connective tissue adaptation, even if you feel capable of more sooner. Otherwise, you risk sidelining yourself right when your metabolic engine is finally running well.
Good advice. Another practical detail that's often overlooked with increased metabolic rate is electrolyte balance.
Oh, absolutely critical. Anytime your cells are working harder, producing more ATP, turning over energy faster, the demand for key minerals skyrockets. You burn through sodium, potassium, and magnesium much more quickly.
Why those specifically?
They are fundamental electrolytes. They're crucial for nerve impulse transmission, muscle contraction, maintaining fluid balance, and countless enzymatic reactions, including those involved in energy production itself. They're like the wiring and the lubrication for the whole system.
So if you boost the engine with 5A1MQ, but don't provide enough electrolytes,
the system can stall. You might experience muscle cramps, fatigue, poor recovery, brain fog, or just feel generally off, even though your NAD plus levels are high. It's essential to consciously track and likely increase electrolyte intake, often significantly above baseline levels, to support the increased metabolic activity enabled by 5A1MQ. Don't neglect the electricians.
Excellent point. Okay, just to wrap up the risks and context, let's quickly contrast 5A1MQ with the more common ways people try to boost energy stimulants, energy drinks. How does it differ fundamentally?
It's a completely different paradigm. Think of 5A1MQ as fixing and upgrading your body's own terrestrial power plant. It works on the foundational infrastructure, mitochondria, NAD+, to provide sustainable baseline energy.
Okay, power plant upgrade. What are the others then?
Stimulant pills, high sugar energy drinks.
Okay.
Those are like flicking the switch on an emergency diesel generator. They work by triggering a stress response, often involving the adrenal glands pumping out cortisol and adrenaline.
Which gives you a temporary surge, but...
But it's borrowed energy. It comes at the cost of stressing the system, often disrupting the very NAD plus pathways we're trying to optimize. And it inevitably leads to a crash or a neurochemical hangover. It's like taking out a high-interest payday loan on your physiology, completely unsustainable.
So one builds capacity, the other just borrows frantically. What about coffee? Where does that fit in? It's still okay.
Coffee generally gets a pass, thankfully. Good quality coffee is actually beneficial. It's packed with antioxidants, has neuroprotective qualities. But it's important to understand how it works relative to something like 5A1MQ.
How does it work?
Coffee, primarily through caffeine, acts more like a volume knob for your existing neurotransmitter signals, particularly adenosine, which promotes sleepiness. It blocks adenosine receptors, making you feel more alert. It makes the existing signals feel louder.
But it's not fundamentally changing the energy production machinery itself.
Exactly. Coffee is a modulator, a volume knob. It's not an engine upgrade. 5A1MQ is aiming to be the engine upgrade. They work through very different mechanisms. #tag outro. Final takeaway. So to kind of wrap things up, what 5A1MQ represents based on the research and reports is a potential pathway towards really durable, profound energy and metabolic efficiency. It aims to achieve this not through stimulation, but by fundamentally fixing the cellular infrastructure, boosting the function of the mitochondria, and crucially, by removing that major metabolic roadblock, the NNMT enzyme.
And the idea is, when your cells are actually running optimally like that,
your innate biological drive tends to get restored. Things like discipline and sticking to healthy habits might feel more authentic, less like a constant battle against fatigue or cravings. Fatigue itself diminishes, and targeted fat loss can become more of a standard outcome because the underlying biological math is finally aligned in your favor.
It's addressing the biology to solve a biological problem rather than just relying on willpower to overcome faulty machinery.
Precisely.
And that brings us to our final thought for you, the listener. Something to mull over, not just about this compound, but about optimizing really any aspect of your life. We saw in the anecdotal report that fixing the main engine with 5A1MQ didn't automatically solve the specific, potentially hormonally driven issue of stubborn lower body fat. It required a different targeted approach.
Right, the global fix didn't address the local problem entirely.
So the lesson is this. If your phone charges agonizingly slowly and never gets past 10% battery, you don't just sit there writing affirmations about patience and acceptance. You figure out why. Is the battery degraded? Is the charging cable frayed? Is the port full of lint? Is there a rogue app draining power? You diagnose the specific bottleneck. Maybe you need to replace the damn battery.
Find the root cause.
Exactly. And even after you replace the battery, maybe you still need to clean the port or update the software. So the question ask yourself in metabolism, in recovery, in productivity, anywhere is, are you truly addressing the foundational infrastructure decay? Are you identifying the specific bottleneck? Or are you just trying to outrun a complex biological or logistical math problem with sheer willpower without considering the necessary, often layered, and specific solutions required? Don't just write affirmations. Find the bottleneck and fix it.